Chapter 14. Frank was surprised by how quickly he was able to cross the valley floor on his way home. He had figured 2, maybe 3 days to reach the LRV camp. But on the evening of the second day, since he reached the bottom of the mountains, he was beginning to be able to make out details of the encampment. He spotted the communications tower first, and now he could see the LRV itself, sitting in the middle of the group of cargo pods and auxiliary huts. There was something odd, though. There was no movement other than the scanner array, slowly turning atop the communications tower. Frank had expected to see at least Mac or Tony outside, doing one of their mundane maintenance chores they were always complaining about. Frank had run various arrival scenarios in his head several times as he made his way across the rolling, grassy terrain. Perhaps he might run into Adia or Laura, out gathering specimens in the fields. But it was late in the day, and maybe they had finished the day's tasks early and were already inside the LRV, enjoying another one of Laura's sumptuous pasta salads, or relaxing in the lounge. Frank could easily envision them inside the LRV, Maria and Laura watching old movies on the video player, Mac and Tony grunting and groaning on the resistance gym, Sarah pedaling her way through another marathon on the exercycle, Lynn meticulously studying the mission profile as she prepared tomorrow's itinerary. It was a comforting vision altogether. But still, there was something wrong. By now, he was far inside the outer sensory perimeter. The sensor stake should have detected his presence and relayed the warning to the computers on the LRV. By now, someone should have come out to investigate the source of the motion. But no one was there. And as he drew closer, he noticed something else that worried him. As the evening light waned, he realized that none of the lights were on. Not the outdoor area floods, not the running lights atop the LRV's tail, not even the warm glow emanating through the LRV's habitat windows. For all intents and purposes, the entire camp looked unoccupied. Frank's trepidation intensified as he approached the encampment. Storage containers were lying about. The ATUV they recovered from the floods had not been cleaned up. Instinct caused Frank to bring his ATC to a stop. He slowly dismounted his vehicle and started walking through the outer border of the camp. Something told him to draw his sidearm. His feeling of relief to be home again suddenly changed to one of fear, fear of what might have happened to his friends. His steps became more cautious as he quietly made his way through the camp. The hair on his neck stood up as he slowly made his way to the front of the ship. The hatchway was dark when he started up the ramp. The only light was the red status light on the hatch control panel, indicating it was locked. That was not unusual, as it was standard operating procedure to lock the outer hatch when everyone was inside the LRV. But the hatch control panel would not accept his access code. Someone had purposely locked him out. "Could they be angry at me?" Frank wondered. He tried his code several times without success. He even tried his command authorization code. It also failed. That meant someone with a higher authorization code than his had locked him out. And that had to be Lynn. Frank unslung his pack from his shoulders and pulled out a small toolkit. He knew every system in this ship, even better than he knew his own children, and it was an easy task to take apart the hatch control panel and manually override the lockout command. Within minutes, the hatch was unlocked. He slowly pushed the hatch open. There were still no lights on in the airlock compartment, and they should have come on automatically when the hatch opened. That meant the ship had been powered down to minimal usage levels. Something was definitely wrong. The ship had been powered down and buttoned up for a reason, and it sure as hell wasn't because they were mad at him for leaving. Frank made his way to the inner hatch, which was also locked. The words "quarantine" and "close outer hatch" flashed in alternating patterns across the inner hatch control panel. This really scared Frank. "Quarantine?" he muttered to himself as he closed the outer hatch. Ventilation fans spun up in the airlock, spreading a fine decontamination mist all over the compartment. Frank closed his eyes and pulled his shirt up over his nose. The decontamination chemicals stunk, and they burned his eyes. A few minutes later, the decontamination cycle finished, and the inner hatch unlocked. Frank entered the habitat less cautiously than he had entered the airlock. Whatever was happening, he didn't feel an immediate threat. But the word quarantine was still burned into the back of his mind. The question was, were they protecting themselves from something outside, or trying to keep something inside from getting out? At this point, it didn't matter. He had to find out what was going on, no matter the risk. And he had to find out now. Frank made his way through the entry corridor and into the main habitat area, finding no one. He continued through the wardroom and into the birthing section. Several of the curtains on the berths were closed. He went to the nearest berth with closed curtains. It was Tony's. Tony? Frank slowly pulled open the curtains, half hoping to find Tony hiding in his berth, waiting to scare him in retribution for his untimely departure. But that would be more Mac's type of joke. Tony was lying on his back in his berth, unmoving. Frank shone his light on Tony's face. Tony? He was pale, and his chest wasn't moving. Frank couldn't detect any signs of life. In fact, Tony looked dead. A knot was developing in Frank's gut, along with a sense of panic. If this was a joke, it wasn't very funny. He went to the next berth over, which was Adia's. Pulling open the curtain, she also appeared dead. Frank noticed that she had an IV port in her left arm. One by one, Frank checked the other berths. Lynn, Mac, Sarah were all lying still like corpses. Frank sat on the bench of the resistance gym in the middle of the berthing section. Tears were welling up in his eyes. Could all of his friends really be dead? It didn't seem possible. A thought pierced through his swirling emotions. Two people were missing, Laura and Maria. Frank rose, stumbling out of the compartment, making his way forward to the med lab. He found Maria, slumped over her computer terminal. She looked terrible. Pale and sickly, with sunken eyes. There was vomit in the trash can and on the floor next to her seat. Frank reached for her neck, feeling for a pulse at her carotid artery. It was faint, but it was there. He carefully picked her up and laid her on the exam table. But he had no idea what to do next. As chief engineer, his training had been more intense than anyone's, except for Jack's. But his medical training had been brief. He managed to hook up the biomonitor. Her vital signs were all wrong. All of her body chemistry was in the red. He had no idea what any of it meant, let alone what to do about it. Frank went to the computer terminal on the counter, called up Maria's log, and began reading. Her most recent entries were mostly gibberish, made up mostly of severely misspelled words. He doubted she had been very coherent at the time. He went back further, catching mention of a disease or a virus, and something about a creature. The monitor started making strange, irregular beeping sounds, moving Frank's attention from the log back to Maria's biomonitor. Her heart rhythm was becoming unstable. Frank panicked, unsure of what to do for her. Frank forced himself to focus. He returned to the computer terminal and switched from the medical log to the protocol database, searching for the treatment protocols for cardiac arrhythmias. After reading furiously for several moments, Frank went to the medicine cabinet, only to find it locked. Shit! Frank cursed. Without hesitation, Frank drew his weapon and blasted the cabinet open, sending vials flying in all directions. Rifling through the open cabinet, he found the vial he wanted and quickly drew its contents up into a pneumoject syringe. After dialing up a dosage, he injected it into Maria's left deltoid muscle. A few moments later, her heart rate increased and settled into a steady, regular rhythm. Relieved, Frank looked around at the damage he had done to the medicine cabinet. There were vials scattered all over the floor and the nearby counter, but there was also a long red case sitting in the middle of the counter. Frank had spent several days in this room recovering from his diving accident. He had no recollection of this case. He made his way back to the counter, curious. He looked at the cover. Reduced metabolic stasis serum. That would explain the others, he thought, a wave of relief washing over him. Opening the case, he found 5 full vials of RMS serum. But there were also 5 empty holes where 5 full vials of serum had once sat. and there were five of his friends lying in their berths, with IV ports in their arms, appearing to be dead.
"Who's there?"
Maria rasped. Her words were so faint, Frank almost didn't hear them. He spun around, finding Maria struggling to open her eyes. He rushed to her side, taking her hand. "It's me, Frank."
"Frank,"
she half smiled.
"You're back."
"What the hell's going on around here?"
"You're not sick?"
"No, I'm not."
Maria suddenly became panicked.
"You shouldn't have come in here."
"You're lucky I did. Your heart almost stopped. I gave you some atropine."
"My pH?"
Frank looked up at the biomonitor. 7.25, he told her.
"Oh, too low for RMS,"
she frowned. "What?"
"Give me some bicarb," she told him. "Above 7.35. Then give me the RMS serum."
"What? I can't do that. It could kill you."
"I'll die if you don't,"
she sobbed, tears flowing from her eyes.
"Please,"
she begged, in a whisper that seemed to require all of her remaining strength. Reluctantly, Frank administered the sodium bicarbonate. Once her pH was above 7.35, he also administered the RMS serum. For nearly an hour, he held her hand as she slipped into stasis. Frank suddenly felt very alone. At first, Jack was able to maintain his pace as he made his way higher into the mountains. The thought of reaching the summit and picking up the LRV signal constantly occupied his mind. Every few days, he would spend some time hunting, cleaning, and cooking his kill, eating what he could, and hauling the rest along with him for sustenance during his journey. Otherwise, his routine was fairly predictable. The weather was not being cooperative. Snowfall seemed minimal, but the wind at the higher elevations brought the nighttime air to bone-chilling temperatures. When he could find a small cave, the fire kept him warm enough to get through the night. Other nights, he was lucky to get a fire lit because of the ice-cold winds. Yet, he somehow managed to get through even the worst nights. The furs helped, as did the blue-gray hair, which seemed to be growing ever thicker on his arms and legs. At first, the unusual hair growth had not worried him. But his concerns grew with each passing day. A few of the men on board the Daedalus had possessed what seemed like abnormal amounts of body hair, something his father had told him was a genetic trait amongst some of the races contained within the Daedalus's gene banks. Jack finally had to attribute his unusual hair growth as his own body's attempt to adapt to the colder environment. Perhaps he, too, had a recessive gene within him that would explain the extra hair now covering most of his arms and legs. He had given up on shaving or trying to cut his hair. Both he and Will had become somewhat shaggy in appearance as the cold weather set in. A heavy beard and longer hair seemed to help combat heat loss from their head and face. But by now, Jack's hair was nearly down to his shoulders, and his beard, also blue-gray in color, was thick and full, hanging down well below the base of his neck. But it worked nicely, creating a barrier to prevent the chilly winds from seeping in around the collar of his crudely fashioned fur parka. In fact, with this much head and facial hair, he rarely found the need to wear his fur head cover, even in the poorest of weather. He had even left Will's furs behind, finding that he no longer needed them to maintain his body temperature.
Mission log, day 67, Chief Engineer reporting. I returned several days ago from my expedition, only to find the entire crew, with the exception of Dr. Gonzalez, in reduced metabolic stasis. Dr. Gonzalez herself was ill and near death. After examining her medical log, I learned that the crew had been infected with some type of alien virus of unknown origin or transmission route. Sadly, it has already taken the life of Dr. Weingarten and severely weakened the rest of the crew. At the request of Dr. Gonzalez, I placed her into stasis. After further examination of the medical and mission logs, I can only assume that something from either the alien creature killed in the Ag Hut or something in the local environment itself has infected them, and that they quite possibly contaminated one another. Because of this,
I have sealed each of them, while in stasis, into their berths, both for their protection as well as my own. Tomorrow, I will begin a careful decontamination of the entire ship. I am the last one remaining, and although I can no longer do anything to help complete the mission, at least I can watch over them and keep them alive until help arrives. Jack sat by the fire, reading Will's journal. He felt guilty even opening it, knowing that it wasn't really for his eyes. But he was lonely. He missed his friend. And he thought that reading his journal a little bit each night might make him feel like Will was still there, with him. Jack decided to start from the beginning, as if he were reading a novel.
October 24th, 2112. My name is Rudolf Scheller. I was born in Austria, on the planet Earth. It may seem odd for me to put it that way, but there is cause to do so. You see, my wife, my children, and I, along with another 20 other families, are currently residing aboard the first interstellar spaceship ever built by humans, and we have just left our home system on a voyage to a new world. It is a world that none of us will ever see. The voyage will take us more than 60 years to complete. Why go, you may ask? I'm not sure I can answer that question. Why does anyone risk all that they know to gamble on the unknown? Maybe it is the discovery. Maybe it's that the Earth has passed her prime and has only a bleak future ahead. Maybe we want to be part of something historic. Or maybe it was my wife's idea. She was approached by the Eden Underground through a close friend at work. They desired her expertise on theoretical methods of cold fusion, so they brought our entire family down to the Australian outback to work in secrecy and safety, away from the prying eyes of the very syndicate sponsoring the project. It all seemed too cloak and dagger for me, but she had lost all her research funding the previous year, and without her work, my wife was a soul without life or purpose. We raised our children in the beautiful desolation of the Australian outback. My wife worked day and night in the labs while I cared for our young. When the children grew more independent, I resumed my career as a chef in the facility's cafeteria. Surprisingly enough, when we were invited to join them on this voyage, our children, old enough to decide for themselves, chose to accept the invitation. So off we went for a wonderful week at the Hiroka Orbital Resort, supposedly as one of many recipients of an international sweepstakes. But when it came time for us all to return to Earth, we made off with the shuttle and made our way to the rendezvous point with the Daedalus, the ship that the Eden Underground had absconded with from Luna Station only 24 hours earlier. So here we are, travelers aboard a stolen starship, hurtling through the blackness of space into the unknown. It is not an easy life, especially for someone who has spent the last 8 years living in the vast openness of the outback. The interior of this ship is cramped, and living accommodations are modest at best. Many of the essential systems are still being installed as I write. But my beloved wife believes in this mission with all her heart, and she believes that here, amongst the stars, free of the corporate blockades that have always succeeded in squashing her efforts, is the only place that she will be able to complete her work. I have landed the position of chief cook. Well, actually, I'm the only cook. The other members of the crew take turns helping me prepare meals for us all. But to stave off the boredom, I have taken it upon myself to try to develop interesting new dishes from the rather limited resources available to me. You would think that a few metric tons of salt would seem an extravagant amount in any kitchen, but consider that it has to last 60-plus years. Our eldest son has taken the role of educator, teaching the youngsters on board their lessons. Our daughter is a skilled nurse and is working with Dr. Bell in the medical clinic. Our youngest has decided that she will follow in her mother's footsteps. I will keep this journal of our lives for posterity. I will chronicle our daily lives as well as the events of the mission. I will pass this responsibility to my son when I die, whom I hope will carry on the process,
passing it down to his son after him. I have chosen to keep this journal by pen and paper. I have always loved books, and I fear this may be the only one to exist in our new world. Who knows? Maybe it will be displayed in a museum someday.
Jack closed the journal as he finished reading the first entry. It was already making him feel better. Maybe it was only a distraction, but it was a welcome one.
Mission Log, Day 72, Chief Engineer Reporting. I have read everything I can about RMS. As far as I can tell, there is nothing that I need to do for them. Their reduced metabolic state should keep the disease from progressing further before help arrives, at least for most of them. However, Mac and Maria were both close to death when they were put under, so they are probably at much higher risk. Other than occasional maintenance chores, I spend most of my time reading medical textbooks from the database in hopes of understanding Maria's theories about the disease. However, being an engineer, I find myself having to read every paragraph several times before I understand it. I seriously doubt that I will be able to make any headway in discovering a cure for what Dr. Gonzalez nicknamed TCS, or Tau Ceti syndrome. April 9th, 2113. Today, the Earth-Mars cargo ship Mazu, which was assumed lost weeks ago, finally caught up to us. How Captain Wilkins ever managed to convince the Mazu's captain to hijack his own ship is beyond me. However, the supplies and additional personnel the Mazu brings have given us a fighting chance once again. Once unloaded, they plan to strip the Mazu and blend her systems in with our own. So much of the Daedalus was either unfinished or had been altered for her new mission to Alpha Centauri B that she was almost unlivable. With the agricultural equipment and resources provided by the Mazu, we will be able to complete the ag deck. In a few months, we may even have our first harvest. I cannot describe how excited I am about having fresh produce again. I, for one, have grown tired of MREs. Along with the arrival of the Mazu came word that the Icarus was also successfully hijacked and should rendezvous with us before we reach the Kuiper Belt. Again, I am amazed at how clever the leaders of the Eden Project are, not to mention how felonious. To steal three ships, it boggles the mind. Although these ships had originally been the property of the Eden Project, legally, the Centauri Syndicate now owns this ship, as well as the Mazu and the Icarus. I cannot help but worry that they will come after us. If the hijacking of the Ozu did not go as planned, the Syndicate could use her to come after us. It is something that I try very hard not to think about. Mission Log, Day 78, Chief Engineer Reporting. I finally figured out how to use the genetic scanners to analyze the samples that Maria left behind. But, to be honest, I don't really know what I'm looking for. I recognize what I see, cells, structures, and the like, but I can't tell if anything is wrong with them. It's like trying to assemble a puzzle that has no picture of the pieces put together. August 17th, 2115. We exited the far side of the Oort cloud today. It turned out to be larger than anyone on Earth could have expected. We were able to use the Mazu shuttles to collect raw materials from an asteroid we passed along the way. It was a tremendous effort and unbelievably risky, but in the end, it was worth it. We are now rich in metals, some basic chemicals and gases, and even water, having found copious amounts of frozen water on the asteroid as well. This is of great relief to the entire population of the ship, since our hasty departure had left us with only the barest of necessities. The fact that the Syndicate had been secretly refitting the ship for a small mining crew instead of 100 colonists only compounded the shortage. Now, we head out across the vastness of space, on our way to the Tau Ceti system, and our best hope of finding a safe world on which our children's children may live and prosper. Teams are rapidly working to bring the observatory online in the hopes that, out here, beyond the reaches of our solar system, new discoveries can be made.
The most exciting of these contemplations is the Luton system. Our course will take us within a light year of this star. We will have an observational opportunity the likes of which has never existed in the history of mankind. A relatively close-up look at another star. If even a lowly cook such as myself is this excited, I cannot imagine how the ship's astronomer must feel.
Mission Log, Day 85, Chief Engineer reporting. I have been forced to all but abandon my attempts at researching TCS. I'm finding that more and more of the equipment is breaking down. Without constant monitoring and maintenance, this place just keeps falling apart. Keeping the ship quarantined this way is a great drain on both myself and the ship's life support systems. This habitat was designed for use on an Earth-like world. It only has the ability to run on internal life support for a few weeks, at best. If this maintenance schedule continues, I will no longer have enough portable air left to use the biosuits outside. I find it hard to believe that TCS could be contracted outside. It has to be from exposure to the alien creature they killed in the Ag Hut. At least, I hope so. Because soon, I won't have any other choice but to expose myself once again to the natural environment of this world. November 13th, 2120. We have been officially outside the Sol system for some time now, so we have truly become interstellar travelers. Although the loss of the Ozu was unfortunate, at least we now know that there is no way for the Syndicate to catch up to us and reclaim their legal property. We have begun our final acceleration push, and within a few months, we will be at our target cruising speed. As I understand it, from that point on, we will be coasting until we reach the point at which we must begin deceleration. The expansion of the Ag Deck is nearly complete, and the green light has been given by the Council for us to begin increasing the size of our population. As a compromise, the Council has agreed to allow each couple to conceive one child using that couple's ovum and sperm, although they will still be required to use in vitro. However, no couple will ever know for sure which of their children is from their DNA, which are from only one parent or the other, and which were conceived using both donor, ovum, and sperm. An odd ruling, to say the least, but a workable compromise, nonetheless. Mission Log, Day 97, Chief Engineer reporting. The last few days, I have not felt myself. I don't know if it is the boredom, the loneliness, or both. My appetite has diminished, but probably because one can only eat protein bars and dehydrated fruit for so long. It has been nearly a week since I began conducting my exterior chores without my biosuit. So far, I haven't noticed any signs or symptoms of TCS, at least none that were listed in the medical logs. I've grown tired of the mindless video flicks that Laura and Maria found so entertaining. Instead, I spend what little free time I have reading some of the classic literature contained in the ship's database. I had always thought it a waste of space, but now I am happy that someone thought to bring these collections along with us. My latest scans of the crew show no substantive changes in their conditions. At least that's something to be thankful for. I've noticed that I find myself thinking less and less about Jack. I don't know if I have finally accepted his death, or if my own situation has grown dire enough to keep thoughts of him from my mind. Jack awoke in the morning with renewed energy and purpose. With any luck, he might reach the summit today. The weather was milder than it had been over the last week. Snow was falling, but the winds were calm, and the going was not terribly difficult. Even Jack's load felt lighter, which hardly seemed possible, as his load had not changed. Nevertheless, his endurance seemed to increase, along with his strength and physical prowess. Jack concluded that long-term exposure to such a harsh life had served to improve both his physical condition as well as his prowess. It seemed only natural. When life got hard, you had to get harder yourself, or die. Jack ran the mental calculations as he made his way up the last stretch of mountainside toward the summit. The Icarus's position when they ejected, their trajectory,
the position of the stars, and the speed at which they had made their way across the planet's surface on their way back to the LRV. He had already run these numbers 100 times. This had to be the last summit.
Sunrise found Frank on his knees, hunched over the toilet, vomiting for nearly 10 minutes.